Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This is episode 41, and I've got to admit, it's a big one for me. I've got a guest on this week's episode that, I rarely ever kind of put lists together of dream guests, bar the entire Coppola family, obviously. But this is one of them, Sean Fennessy, who you may recognize from The Big Picture, the Rewatchables podcast, the Prestige TV pod. He's fantastic. He's over there at The Ringer, just kind of putting together these amazing podcasts. And somebody who I've listened to for so long and I just kind of really, really love everything that Sean does. And I don't know, it felt like a weird experience for me in the fact that you listen to people and you almost like get a sense of who they are. And it definitely helped the conversation to some degree. It's like I knew the touch points that Sean is familiar with, having listened to hundreds of hours at this point of him on The Big Picture, especially, and the Rewatchables to some degree as well, just kind of knowing the references he knows, knowing how much he's got this love for the new Hollywood, the movie brats and stuff like that. So he was the perfect guest for this podcast, and I'm absolutely delighted that he agreed to join me. Like when I sent him an email being like, hey Sean, I know that you're a fan of 80s Coppola work, come and talk about a film that you probably don't get to talk about. And I think originally I pitched Tucker, The Man and His Dreams, and Sean said, hey, I really want to talk about Gardens of Stone. And we really get into it on this one. We kind of talk about where Coppola was at that time, kind of stuff that happened in his personal life, what the state of the kind of movie brats as a whole was like, and even down to like James Caan and Angelica Houston, kind of where this sits in their filmographies. And it made for a really fun, interesting conversation, and I'm sure you will really enjoy it. Obviously, as ever, we will be spoiling this film. We kind of, leave no stone unturned, pun intended there. So if you haven't seen this film, I really recommend picking it up on a beautiful Indicator Blu-ray that's been released, which has got this amazing Francis Ford Coppola interview from 2018. And me and Sean discuss it in this chat. And yeah, it's a fantastic set, and Indicator, as always, put out these amazing Blu-rays, and this is definitely one of them. If not, just listen to the conversation anyway. This is a great one. It's a massively underseen Francis Ford Coppola film, and we get into, does it work? Does it not? Have a listen and find out. So I guess all that's left to do is to rail against the Vietnam War, take a new recruit under your wing as we head to the Arlington National Cemetery and make some Coppola connections. Today, we're joining the old guard, the toy soldiers, whose guns don't fire, whose bayonets don't fix, the kabuki theatre of the American Army, as we look at Francis Coppola's 1987 drama film, Gardens of Stone, written by Ronald Bass, based on a book by the same name by Nicholas Prophet. Film stars James Caan, Angelica Houston, James Earl Jones, and D.B. Sweeney. Joining me in the battalion today to see if the Coppola family are the greatest film family of all time or deserve to be stripped of their medals and court-martialed is a man you may have heard on The Ringer's Big Picture podcast, The Rewatchables, or the Prestige TV pod. Sean Fennessy, how are you today, sir?
Hi, sir. So delighted to be here and make some big decisions about one of the great film families of all time.
Well, we've got two of them involved in the same film, right? I guess Angelica and the Houstons can be considered.
But let's not forget James Caan and Scott Caan, of course.
of course.
Legacy all their own.
definitely. Well, before we get into talking about the film, all things Coppola, tell us a little bit about what you do on The Big Picture specifically. It's a podcast I absolutely love.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, one, I'm really happy to be here to talk to you about this movie that I never get a chance to talk about. On the show that I host, we don't really talk about movies like this, which are deeply underseen, little seen, smaller films from great filmmakers. I try my best on the show to shed some light on some of them, but it's a contemporary movie podcast about new releases that features conversations with me and my co-host Amanda Dobbins and our pal Chris Ryan and a number of other folks who work at The Ringer, which is a sports and pop culture media company that is now owned and operated by Spotify. We make a lot of podcasts. We have a website. And The Big Picture, you know, I have long conversations with filmmakers about new releases. The show has kind of expanded over time to become much more gamified, much more historically minded. We try to talk about our favorite filmmakers, Coppola, of course, being one of them, and celebrate what we like. And get a little bit weird in the process. This is the kind of movie, though, that we don't usually get a chance to talk about too much because it's kind of hard to see, kind of hard to find, doesn't have a big reputation. But here we are on this show, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, the amount of people who I've mentioned this film to and they kind of blank expressions. Do you know what I mean? You go, Gardens of Stone? They're like, Francis Coppola, 1987. I think a lot of the movie brats kind of, you can pick out a film from any of those kind of guys, like especially their 80s output, and kind of say, like, I don't know, Spielberg. Always? Did he direct Always or something?
He did.
Yeah. Always, and people go, I even doubted myself. Do you know what I mean? And it is a kind of, yeah, it's an 80s Spielberg film.
I think that's a great comparison. I feel like Gardens of Stone is the Always in his filmography, in Coppola's filmography, but Always even is a bigger and more well-known film than this film. This is part of the, like, let's go behind the curtain. You asked me to come on the show and you said, I heard you talk about 80s Coppola on a pod once, mm-hmm. and you suggested Tucker, Man in His Dream, which is a very, very good film that Coppola made. That was kind of a lifelong dream of his to make a film about this guy who you can see this major kind of, reflection of his aspirations and his big dream, his ambition. And Gardens of Stone is not that. It's a totally different kind of film. Totally. So it seems like sort of a paycheck job, but is a deeply melancholy movie and comes at this very curious time in history, reflecting on history that had come 15, 20 years before it. And it's a real curio. I mean, it's an authentically unknown movie from one of the 10 most significant American directors of the last 50 years. So that's so interesting that this even exists in this, and has this reputation or lack thereof.
Well, I'll say this up top. There's actually an amazing Blu-ray that's been put out by Indicator that I like from looking at it, it's region unlocked as well. So like, I think anyone can buy it and watch it. And that's like the fact I saw that was a thing. I was a bit like, oh, okay. Do you know what I mean? Like this thing that, and again, they're quite a curio label as well. So like that was a kind of mark of like, oh, this is probably a bit different. Do you know what I mean?
I love Indicator. Indicator is an incredible line. Anybody who's ever heard me on pods knows that I'm a bit of a physical media obsessive, and filling out my Coppola collection with Gardens of Stone when they issued this, like 18 or 19, a few years ago. And
2018, yeah.
18, yeah. and is a beautiful restoration of the movie. You know, it looks great. It, like, the only time I had ever seen this prior to getting that my hands on that copy was seeing it on cable growing up. I think it had a little bit of an HBO run in the early 90s, and as I recall, it kind of looked like shit. It was very muddy, and it had that kind of like that 80s film stock quality of grayness. Yes. And this is a very dour movie at times, so it's not inappropriate, but that indicator version is phenomenal. It has great pictures. It has a wonderful booklet, interview with Coppola talking about the making of the movie, which he hardly remembers, which is also a fascinating thing. There's so much about this movie that is interesting.
Yes, well, before we get too deep into talk about the film, let me ask you about like your knowledge of the Coppola family, and like specifically, like, who was your entry point, and when did it kind of, I don't know, like the gates open, and then you realize, oh, there's a whole heap of them.
That's a good question. So I think, I'm going to be 40 this year. So my first memory of the idea of the Coppola clan was probably The Godfather Part III, which, you know, came out in 1990. And I remember there being a lot of hubbub around the film, largely because of the controversy of Sofia Coppola's performance and the idea of nepotism and the idea of this great filmmaker inserting daughter into this significant role in the film. And I hadn't seen The Godfather at that point. I think I probably just saw the cover of Entertainment Weekly that my mom subscribed to and probably found my way into it that way. And then a couple of years later, I think Bram Stoker's Dracula is the first Coppola movie that I really wanted to see.
Yeah.
And I probably saw The Godfather shortly thereafter, maybe 11 or 12 years old. I caught it on AMC, probably, or airing it. They aired it hundreds and hundreds of times in the States. So, but I think Godfather Part III is when I became aware of the concept of probably even powerful families in movies, you know, and then you start to make those, you draw the line from Kirk Douglas to Michael Douglas, you know, and you start to see that their lineage is such a significant part of this creative industry. And that, you know, we were even just talking before we started about this journey that you're on with, you know, tying together all these strands of connectivity through marriage and, you know, through divorce and through stepchildren and how widespread it is. But the Coppolas in particular, they share their artistry. You know, you can see Francis bringing his kids on the set of Apocalypse Now had an impact on them. You know, casting his sister in a film had, you know, expands the palette of this major creative family. So I don't know. On the one hand, as a recent father, I love the idea of like giving your kids something that is important to you, like your work.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think it makes people kind of queasy.
Yeah, I've said it before on this podcast, which I find like quite funny is, seems to be an entertainment, like it's an icky thing, but like it's a mark of like if you find out, oh, that bistro, like it's been in the family years, it's like a mark of like greatness. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, whereas if you'd kind of trained your son up from or your daughter from a young age to kind of move into the family business, whether that is being a director, which I imagine like you're saying, being on the set of Apocalypse Now and kind of 3 months old, being like the baby and the godfather, having that experience, what else are you going to do if that's all you know? Do you know what I mean? If kind of dinner parties or dinners are kind of discussing scripts and stuff like that, that's going to eke into you. Whereas, yeah, if you're a carpenter and your dad's kind of doing that in the work shed and you get interested as a kid, like, surely going to grow up to do that.
Yeah, I think there is the myth of meritocracy in the arts, especially the mainstream arts, that I think, and maybe this is just an American thing, you tell me, but people want to get behind the person they've never seen before that didn't have a leg up. But the truth is, and like we've seen this now, I assume you're a fan of Sofia's films, but I mean, Sofia has now proven herself to be like a pretty stellar film artist, you know, with a real point of view, a real style. You know, there are like things you can criticize her films for, which are obviously kind of endemic to her experience as a person. But I love her movies. And I think there is, I don't know if my daughter will turn out to be a mediocre or above podcaster. I suspect that being around me a lot and having to hear me blather on, she'll pick up a few things.
Yes.
And I don't think there's anything bad about that. I mean, I think the legacy of Hollywood is the legacy of families in many ways. So, you know, they're the Warner Brothers, not Mr. Warner. You know what I mean? So I don't think there's anything necessarily inherently bad about it.
Definitely. Well, you've obviously interviewed a lot of like directors and filmmakers. Have you ever spoke to a Coppola at all, Sean?
Yeah. I've interviewed Sophia on The Big Picture. She joined, actually, it's a very rare interview in which my co-host Amanda joined me in the interview. Amanda doesn't love to sit for the director interviews, but she worships at the altar of Sophia. So when On the Rocks was released a couple of years ago, we did that together, and she was lovely. She gave us a lot of her time, and she was insightful. I'm trying to think. I mean, I've met Jason Schwartzman in passing in private. I've never interviewed him for any particular reason. I'm trying to think. Never spoken to Cage. Never spoken to Francis. I've made my bid for Francis, and I would still love to speak to Francis. But I have not spoken with him. Certainly haven't spoken to Talia Shire. Haven't spoken to Roman. I've seen Roman dining many times in Los Angeles. We frequent some of the same haunts. Gosh, I'm trying to rack my brain. You know, the younger cohort like Gia and folks like that, I have never spoken with. Who am I forgetting? I mean, you're the expert on this.
Oh, yeah, no, there's like a, I don't know, Chris Coppola. Have you seen a guy kind of waltzing around LA who kind of looks like a pirate? A bit like Nick Cage.
have not spoken with Chris, no.
Oh, that's, you're missing out. He's a lovely gentleman. Right, so what would have been, I think you've already answered this with Bram Stoker's Dracula being your first Coppola film. Is that right?
I think so. Well, it's certainly the one that I remember getting excited about. Mm-hmm. You know, that was sold to me on television, that I saw on magazine covers. That was a big event movie at the time. And I don't know if I actually saw it in the fall that it was actually released. Because like I said, I was only 10. It's a fairly violent film. Maybe it might have been a couple of years later when I actually got a chance to see it. But that probably like unlocked my awareness of Coppola as a big deal director. And that's really him coming out of, including Part 3, this kind of down period, this kind of blue period in which he is taking on, you know, these for-hire jobs. Peggy Sue Got Married, Gardens of Stone. He makes the Tucker movie, which is, you know, not super successful. None of these films are really all that successful. And I do remember loving Dracula. I do remember thinking it was dynamite.
Yeah, there's something interesting about the 80s Coppola as well, that it seems to be 1984 he drops the Ford. So like this film, The Cotton Club through to Godfather, like Godfather Part 3 is when he like reinstates the Ford. It's like, I'm back, baby. And I always like to think of the kind of, like the psychology to that, like, I don't know, is it like him kind of like being like, this isn't the same guy almost, do you know what I mean? These are like jobs for hire. Because there's something fascinated about that period. And obviously somebody who's like not just a director, he's a screenwriter as well. And he's like kind of famed for writing his own scripts or adapting his own stuff. And that period, like this film as well, is written by somebody entirely different. He didn't have a hand in the script at all, on a credit level at least.
Yeah, when I was first really getting into movies and the idea of the filmography in the 2000s, I probably was more harsh than I should have been about filmmakers like Coppola who went into these kind of down periods over time. But candidly, as I get into my 40s, and I think Coppola was like 45 or so when he made this movie, I kind of get it. You know, your kids are a little bit more grown. You've been doing something for 20 years. Things are not as exciting to you as they used to be. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, you had a moment where you felt like, wow, I was really at the top of my game, and now I don't really know how to get back to that. But I still got to pay the bills. I've still got this massive production company that I need to support, or I've got this villa, or I've got aging parents, or I've got all of these kind of responsibilities. And so for an artist who seemed to be really following his light, especially post-apocalypse now, where he's like, screw it, I'm doing One from the Heart, I'm doing The Outsiders and Rumble together, I'm putting all of my chips down on the Cotton Club, you can feel him resetting and taking things to pay some bills and to maybe just reimagine how he wants to do the work that he does. And it creates this kind of like, I don't know, like quasi-bland art that I still think is really interesting. Like Gardens of Stone, I think, lacks strong point of view, in part because of what you just said, that he didn't write this movie and you don't necessarily feel like he has a deep emotional connection to this story. But there are a couple of moments in the movie, I think even of like a moment when Angelica Houston's character comes over at Jimmy Khan's house for the first time. You can see like the camera kind of trailing Khan throughout this tiny little apartment that he lives in, where I'm like, this is way more advanced than some workaday TV movie director would do. It's like he didn't have to like shoot Khan through the little cutout in his kitchen and then have the camera track back over the fireplace and the bookcase. And there's still moments where there is kind of great artistry happening sort of in silence. Uh-huh. And so I'm always interested in looking at these kinds of work. It's like a lot less rewarding to look at The Godfather for me, because there's nothing I can say about The Godfather that anyone hasn't heard 1,000 times, you know?
That's the exact problem I had like doing this podcast. I was like, I've got to put out an episode. It's the 50th anniversary, but it's like I'm much more inclined to talk about One from the Heart, because it's like that's so fascinatingly more interesting in the way that it's kind of this folly, right? It's kind of somebody who has spent like years in the jungle. Is like, oh, I'm gonna lock myself in a tin can and direct from like a mobile home and try and. If I could, I would do this as one take and kind of do it as like a live TV play. And it's like that's I don't know. Yeah, the like doing the research of The Godfather. It's like I read like 4 books, and I'm like, I've got too much information in my head to talk about this film. I can't like unless I do like a 24-hour pod. There's no way I'm getting all this information out of my head.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit. I brought up my kid twice now, but it reminds me of having conversations with people about having a kid. Where uh-huh. I'm like, how do I have a thought here that is useful to you? Like, how do I share a reflection on the experience of becoming a parent that doesn't sound like the most banal, cliche crap? And I feel the same way talking about The Godfather, where I'm like, oh, it's a story about America and families and the way that power is passed down and is distorted through history. It's like, everybody knows. We know. The Godfather. Gardens of Stone. How many people have seen this movie?
Yes.
Less than a million? Like, not a lot of people have seen it.
Yeah, I'm hoping people listen to this this episode on name recognition of yours alone, as opposed to have seen the film, Sean.
I'm sorry if I shanked you. You know, we could have done Apocalypse Now, but I wanted to do this.
It's fine. Well, yeah, let's have a deep dive into Gardens of Stone. But before we do that, let's listen to a beautiful VHS trailer I've pulled.
Who is this guy?
He's the best damn soldier on this post.
What's he doing here?
He did serve 2 tours of Nam, man.
Arlington National Cemetery, 1968. There was a war being fought 10,000 miles away.
Willow here, he wants to go to Vietnam. He feels that an infantryman's place at the time of war is the front.
There ain't no front in Vietnam.
Well, what's the story, General? We went into war in Vietnam like Westy says, huh?
You want to go to Vietnam?
A soldier in the right place at the right time can change the world.
It was tearing apart the people at home.
Yeah, I care about the United States Army. That's my family. Only one I got. And I don't like it when it's in trouble.
Klaus sees this war as bad judgment. A screw-up. I see it as genocide.
But I thought the best thing I could do for the Army, my Army, is to get snot-noses like these ready for the inevitable. And that's why I want to teach.
Klaus!
Sir?
You just applied for a transfer and I denied it.
TriStar Pictures presents a film from Francis Coppola.
Well, this unit, Nam, they print up these little cards. They say, killing is our business, and business is good.
Gardens of Stone.
Well, here, burying is our business. Our business is better.
It was a dangerous time to be young.
Men come home crazy and broken and cold.
An impossible time to be a hero.
Not like the other wars. Hell, it's not even a war.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Nothing to win, no way to win it.
Gardens of Stone. A story about the other side of war. The war at home.
Do search. Hard to believe it's only a year. Feels like I've lived my whole life here. It's hard to believe you exist. Even Rach. It's so hard to believe that she still loves me, that there's any love anywhere. I just want to hold her and hold her. Then I'll be all right.
Gardens of Stone. With James Caan, Angelica Houston, James Earl Jones.
Just us and those like us. Damn few left.
Gardens of Stone.
And if you weren't sure, that was the trailer for Gardens of Stone, which I think has a total count of about 5 times it's said in that trailer. So some quick stats on the film. It was made on a budget of $13 million with a box office return of $5 million and some change. It didn't wash its face at the box office. It was released on May the 8th, 1987. Score was composed by Francis's own father, Carmine Coppola. The DOP on this film was Jordan Cronenworth. And there's a host of Coppola regular contributors and collaborators involved in the film, whether it's Dean Tavalaris with set decoration or Fred Roos, his kind of go-to guy when it comes to casting. So, Sean, can you give us a synopsis for what Gardens of Stone is about?
Sure. It's essentially a snapshot of the unit that manages Arlington National Cemetery, where those who served in the armed forces in the United States are buried. One of the most well-known cemeteries in all of America. And it features a young aspirant enlisted man played by D.B. Sweeney coming to terms with his desire to get into war in the face of a couple of men who've spent a lot of time dealing with war. He's essentially in a kind of training as he pushes to get to the front lines of a war in which, as James Caan's character says, there are no front lines. James Caan is a decorated major, I want to say, and or maybe perhaps a lieutenant. I can't remember what his rank is. And James Earl Jones is just effectively his boss and his pal. And they oversee kind of like the decorative burials, the rituals of burial that happen at this cemetery. And they train men in this space to kind of respect the power of the service. And it's kind of a soft soap opera, you know, the James Caan character meets a woman played by Angelica Houston, who's a Washington Post reporter. They kind of fall in love and have begin this affair. D.B. Sweeney's character, the young enlisted man, reunites with the girl that he was in love with, and then they figure out if they're going to be together over time. And it's kind of this tangled story about like legacy and what we give to each other and what we take away from each other, and the dutifulness that I think a lot of people who serve in the armed forces in the late 60s felt, even if they were in conflict with the idea of the Vietnam War. It's not a perspective you see that often, like about older soldiers not being for the war. And it's all set against this very kind of stately, like I said, ritualistic world burial. Mm-hmm. So the metaphors are not modest. They're pretty in your face. And the tone is very, like I said, can be very kind of dour. It's not a very funny movie. It's not very light on its feet. But it is, it's seeking grace in a very ungraceful time in America. Yes. Which I find really interesting.
Well, what I find fascinating is in that, on that indicator disc, Francis Ford Coppola talks about like, what is a true anti-war movie? He says like, you can't make an anti-war movie if you're kind of titillating the audience with like scenes of war. So he like his own admission, like he's like, Apocalypse Now, that's not an, like, that can't be an anti-war movie in my eyes. Like that, like I'm kind of playing to the cheap seats here in regards to like, I'm showing you the stuff you want to see. I'm showing the napalming. I'm showing the kind of violence and the kind of, I'm showing it. I don't know. He's got this, you can tell it's very much from this liberal, most like hippie eyes of like, this isn't good. And it, and obviously ultimately it is, Heart of Darkness kind of set in Vietnam as a kind of, backdrop for it. But like he said, Gardens of Stone, from what he remembers, is more true to being like an anti-war movie and the fact that it's kind of about the fallout of war and the kind of people back home and the kind of like a lot of war movies kind of tend to forget about. It's like we, when we think of war movies, obviously, yeah, we think of kind of Saving Private Ryan and, do you know what I mean, stuff that is frontline and kind of bombastic and stuff like that. And it's these more, this is a bit more of a character study into what's like, yeah, and like you said about James Caan's character, what it's like to be at home and be opposed to it, but also this is all you know. Like you kind of, you're institutionalized into the military and you're trying to, I don't know, you're trying to battle that internal struggle and the kind of the ironies in this film as well, like the inevitable fate of D.B. Sweeney's characters. Crushing. It's heartbreaking stuff, but I don't think it lands, but we can probably talk about that a bit more later.
Yeah, it's the Caan character obviously is the fulcrum of the movie. He's obviously the biggest star in the movie. It's a reunion of sorts for Caan and Coppola. And one of the things that I like about the movie, which I think it's fair to say, despite the fact that I wanted to talk about this, is I agree with you, it's ultimately unsuccessful. Think the movie in a few ways, which is one of the things that makes it so relevant, is that Coppola has these like wild swings that can be hugely successful, but he has very few like right down the middle pitches. And like an anti-war movie in the mid 80s was very in vogue. So it's not, this is 1 year after Platoon, it's 1 year before Casualties of War. Like it's not like he was out on a limb here with the point of view that he was sharing. We'd kind of agreed as a nation that this was a terrible thing that we did for, you know, 10, 12, 15 years ago. So, but the Caan character is in this, is kind of in the crosshairs of his own ideology, because on the one hand, at Arlington, he's considered like a rebel who speaks out too much and has too much point of view about the unnecessary and kind of vile nature of this war. But then he's forced to kind of defend the honor of the military and all of these kind of public functions that he attends. And in this moment, you know, this party that he goes to with Angelica Houston's character, where he kind of punches out an anti-war activist who goads him on. And so it's like every other Francis Ford Coppola movie. It's like, it's about a man in crisis. Like almost all of his movies are about these guys who have these deep moral dilemmas, who are trying to work their way through how they feel about these things. There are of course some exceptions to that, but for the most part, you know, he has plenty in common with Martin Sheen going down the river, with Michael Corleone, you know, with these people who have to make these critical decisions in their lives despite feeling the opposite way. It's a really interesting movie. The movie that, the Vietnam movie that it reminds me the most of is Coming Home. That's probably one of the few movies that the Hal Ashby movie in the late 70s, Jane Fonda, John Voight, and Bruce Dern, about exactly what you just described. Kind of the consequences of what happens when you're done with the war, but the war's not done with you. And it feels similarly weighed down by a lot of those ideas. Coming Home has some exaltation in it, you know. Even Bruce Dern's kind of like ultimate fate in that movie has a kind of like catharsis to it. Yeah. This movie doesn't really give you a lot of that.
And I think like to pinpoint it, like there's obviously a whole factor of reasons why this film probably doesn't get off the ground and kind of work. And I think the biggest one, and it'd be remiss not to mention it, is just the year previous, like I'd imagine it, like the shooting of this, his son passed away, which obviously like mirrors the kind of thematic like elements of this film. Like Coppola has talked about it and said the reason he kind of carried on with the film was he just needed something to do. Otherwise he would be at home kind of grief stricken. And it's, I don't know, it's heartbreaking. Do you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, take that, like you almost like want to go back and like say, like, do you know what I mean? Give him a hug and be like, Francis, take this time out. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, not that it matters if you put out a shit movie because of it, but like you should, like this isn't it. Do you know what I mean? This isn't the one. This is what you should be doing right now. Yeah, I find that aspect. And he was supposed, Giancarlo Coppola was supposed to be in this film as well, as was the gentleman who was responsible for the crash, which like, took his life.
It's a chilling story. I mean, you're right that there is such clear, not just thematic, but almost specific echoes of losing a sort of like not just a surrogate son, but an actual son. In the middle of the production of this film, you mentioned Griffin O'Neill, who had been cast in the film, who was responsible for the accident, and I think was later convicted of manslaughter because of his role in the accident. And at the same time, Giancarlo's fiance was pregnant with Francis's soon-to-be granddaughter, Gia Coppola, who now a filmmaker herself. And then, you know, Coppola dedicates Tucker to his late son. And then there's a sequence in the film Twixt that is essentially like, feels like a recreation of this death. And so this is such a signal event in Coppola's life. Obviously, the highest tragedy you can imagine, losing a child. And he's making a movie about loss, about coping with loss, and about coping with the sort of like the generational frustrations and confusion, and trying to like show people the way to understand, like, don't make the same mistakes that I made, and be careful with your life, and be thoughtful about spending time with the people that you love. So the movie has just got this huge anchor on it, this big emotional anchor that you can understand why he doesn't really have a ton of memories, because if something like this happened to you, you would have blotted out this period of time in your life. Yeah. So it's unusual to think of someone, such a great and well-known artist, to be spending his time making something that he then like almost disassociates from for years and years and years.
Well, I think it's really fascinating that it's one from the heart, right? There's kind of like, there is a kind of fork in the road in Francis Ford Coppola's career that it could have gone another way without that film kind of failing and the closing down of Zoetrope Studios. It's kind of, you can almost look in this multiversal way of like kind of what could have Francis's career could have been if that film was a success, or if he had made some different decisions on that. Because it kind of feels like, you say, right up until Bram Stoker's Dracula, that he's paying that back. And it's that horrible feeling as well that like, knowing that you kind of have to go to work, even though you wish you could take the time off to grieve. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's kind of like, no, you need to, you got like, do you know what I mean? You got the bank manager knocking on the door saying like, hey, you still owe us for that folly you had in 1981.
I mean, on the one hand, we've all been there, right?
Like, yeah.
Gotta pay my rent.
Yeah,
gotta put food on the table. Gotta take care of things. On the other, it's always been one of the most fascinating parts of his career and his identity is as a person who took big risks, who often put his own fortune on the line to make the things that he wanted to, often at cross purposes with his closest friend. You know, like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, men who were kind of proteges in some respects to him, Lucas in particular, But he was older than them. He was more accomplished. He won an Oscar at a very, you know, he was in his early 30s when he won his first Oscar. He made what most people still consider the greatest American film of all time. Once you've done that, right, you've won an Oscar at 31, you made The Godfather and The Godfather Part II in your mid-30s, people are like, you're set. You're set forever. Like, you never have to do another thing for the rest of your life, and your legend is in stone. And to go cut 10 years later, and you got to direct Peggy Sue Got Married, a movie that I like, that I think is a lot of fun. But to have to make that movie because you got to do what you were describing, it's got to be kind of degrading. It's got to be like, got to be a little taxing. And even when you hear him talk now, I'm so interested in him now, you know, in his 80s, mm-hmm. and kind of talking about how he has spent long swaths of his career. Like, he still has regrets. He still has, maybe they're not regrets, but he still is doing that same sliding doors game that you're doing, which is like, if only this movie had been a hit, I wouldn't have had to spend this time doing this. Or if, you know, he still can't get Megalopolis off the ground. It's so interesting that he's still like desperate to make this epic $100 million science fiction life of the mind movie, because he couldn't make it, because he frittered away his power by taking great risks that were too big creatively that he wasn't ready to accomplish. So I don't know, that boldness, that fearlessness is his best friend and his enemy. And so it makes him such a fun character in the history of movies.
Yeah, definitely. He's kind of like, he was like the first over the kind of the top, as it were, like, to use like military metaphor, especially for like the kind of cohort that he's kind of known to be with, like those movie brats. It's like he's a bit of that, but like, he was kind of doing it a bit more, like, do you know what I mean? He was doing stuff in the 60s still. He's kind of like, yeah, the first one over the wall, kind of being like, hey, this is how it's done. I remember, like, there's amazing stories of him quite early on saying, like, he would be doing these studio pictures, and they did Finian's Rainbow for like Warner Brothers. But he would be kind of raiding the cupboards for like film stock and stuff like that, so he could go out and film what he wanted to make. Do you know what I mean? He's like, hey, Easy Rider's coming this way down the country. We're going the other way, filming the Rain People. It's like, let's kind of like, let's fuck shit up a bit and kind of like, let's go crazy with it. And it's like, it's amazing and fascinating to see the kind of ebbs and flows of his career throughout the years. And obviously, yeah, Megalopolis, if that happens, it will be like, oh, Netflix, give him that money. Come on.
Seriously, what else are you spending your money on? It's funny, I just saw Dimension 13 for the first time this year. I'd never seen it before, which is his first movie. And have you talked about it on this show?
Not yet. No. It's not, nobody's picked it.
Okay. I mean, it, another movie that had been a little bit tricky to find until it was reissued somewhat recently on Blu-ray. And very short movie, hugely economical, kind of a classic Roger Corman thing where it's like a high concept genre movie executed on a very small budget. And you can see in that movie so much invention, you know, so much. I actually was just watching the first episode of new season of Atlanta, and the opening scene in that first new season echoes the opening scene in Dementia 13. And I don't know if that's purposeful. I don't know if the Glover family was checking out Coppola's oeuvre, but you can see it's the exact thing that you're describing, which is like, this is a risk taker. This is someone who's pushing it. This is someone who's scrimping and saving to get the most out of this experience all the way through, which is so different from this kind of steel-plated, economically minded Spielbergian vision of American greatness. You know, mm-hmm. like, Spielberg is an amazing artist, one of my favorite directors. I wouldn't describe him as a risk taker. He has made films that are risky, but like, is he a risk taker?
Or even like George Lucas. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of, whilst Francis Ford Coppola was like, hey, I'll put my house on the line so you can make your experimental sci-fi movie, like with THX-1138. It's like, he then goes on to like make Star Wars and is like, yeah, hey, I'm gonna really secure myself and get like the kind of, you know what I mean, rights to the toys and stuff like that and kind of be set for life. Whereas Coppola's going, hey, let's move to the Philippines for 3 years to make this movie, which I don't know how it's going to turn out, but something will come out at the end of it.
It's funny because I'm as obsessed with the movie brats as anybody, and that whole generation of filmmakers. I think I'm equally drawn to the men who have retained their heavyweight status as those who have kind of fallen into a second tier. You know, I love the persistently persnickety rebel nature of De Palma. and his work throughout the years. I like how he seems like kind of a prick, you know, in an appealing way. And same for Paul Schrader. You know, I like how those guys are kind of ornery and they make what they want to make. And the studios are squeezing their necks. They'll find a way to kick out and do what they want to do. And if they don't, they won't work with that studio again. And I love Star Wars. You know, I love that kind of crass commercialistic point of view that Lucas had to retain the rights to those characters. I think that's actually quite savvy and quite interesting. And I love those stories. Coppola has always been kind of the bridge, right? He's always the middle character. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy who could make big, bold commercial entertainments, but was always trying to do them desperately on his own terms, trying to reach as many people as possible, but not sacrificing his idiosyncrasy for it. So this is like, this movie is not that. You know, this movie is like not a crowd pleaser. It's kind of weird that it would be considered a paycheck job. You know, most paycheck jobs, there's a kind of like, I don't know, like either moral depravity or like a genre element, yes, or you know, something high concept, or it's a low tone. Yeah, it's a low toned drama. That's it.
Yeah, that is what's like fascinating about it. So I know that Coppola said, like, when he handed in the final film, producers said, like, oh, it's not emotional enough, and it's not involving enough. And obviously, like, that can't, like, what do you expect from a filmmaker who's kind of like his head's not probably in the game entirely, but like, what were they expecting? I can only imagine that they were expecting like this really melodramatic, do you know what I mean? Like really play for the cheap seats kind of movie of like, do you know what I mean? Like really weepy when we find out that the Willow character has died and stuff like that, and a bit more broad. And yeah, what Coppola does something that is, I would say the film is, it's quite episodic. It's just kind of like these snapshots of what it's like to be living at this time and kind of doing this job, whether it's, I don't know, like, and you just get to know these characters over time. But I think where it falls down is sometimes you don't get to know them enough. And I think like D.B. Sweeney's doing his best, but I just don't think he's the right fit for this role. I just don't think he's got the chops to kind of like really sell us that character. He's kind of, I don't know, like flying up from like 0 to 100. Do you know what I mean? Like whether it's that scene when he's discussing with his old flame about like, you still love me? It's just out of nowhere. And it's a bit like kind of jarring for an audience to watch. Whereas like there you feel like, just I've been trying to rack my brain since watching it, like who around this time would have been great in that role. Like, I don't know, would obviously just done Platoon, but like imagine like Charlie Sheen in like this kind of role.
He sprung to mind. Well, it's funny too, because one of Coppola's great achievements in the 80s is the discovery of all of these incredible talents in The Outsiders and Rumblefish. And so could Matt Dillon have done this? Could Tom Cruise have done this? Could Ralph Macchio have done this? I don't know. Maybe not Ralph Macchio, but you know what I mean. Like there, he was exposed to all of these really great 20-something actors. And Sweeney apparently, I mean, reportedly got Shoeless Joe in Eight Men Out based on this work, based on this performance. This is really his first big role. And he was, for those of you who are not our age, you know, he was kind of a thing in the 90s, D.B. Sweeney. Yeah. You know, he was a guy. He was present. You know, like he was in some big-ish movies. He's in a little over his head here, especially because every other actor, with the exception of Mary Stuart Masterson, is like a 50-year-old person who is incredibly good. And so there's so much more confidence in James Caan's performance and Angelica Houston's performance and James Earl Jones' performance. James Earl Jones and James Caan's characters, they are old friends and they feel like old friends.
Yes.
You know, their connection in this, their chemistry in this movie is amazing. And the movie is kind of at its best when it's playing with that. When Dean Stockwell is kind of at loggerheads with Caan, or when, you know, Caan and James Earl Jones are having dinner with their respective flames. And you're right to call it episodic because it is just kind of a series of scenes in a lot of ways. And the movie does give away basically like what the conclusion of the film is in the opening minutes, which is a convention that would go on to become like very popular in movies, but was not as popular at this time. So it does feel like you're kind of, you're rowing to a destination you've already seen in a lot of ways. And so there's not a lot of dramatic tension in the movie. But I love it for the Caan, Houston, James Earl Jones parts of it. That's really what sings.
Yeah, I love, like you said about that, that dinner scene, and there's something about like just James L. Jones. He just feels familiar. He feels like somebody you know, and the kind of like just the way he's about, and he's kind of got those like sly comments to James Caan in the kitchen. He's kind of he really does reek of that person who is kind of like, ah, oh, I'm the guy at work who's telling the dirty jokes, but I'm on my best behavior for you right now and stuff like that. And I really love that. But he's a really warm character, James Owen. And for me as well, like, I don't know, like it might be the stuff of James Earl Jones that I've seen, but like it feels like a departure from what he's like readily known as for a lot of people. Do you know what I mean? People think Mufasa, people think the old guy from The Sandlot. People, do you know what I mean? People think the voice of Darth Vader. They don't tend to think of him being like the kind of, I don't know, he's like a brash guy in this. He's not that archetype that you think of.
Yeah, it's funny because he's in the middle of a period in which I think he's redefining himself as an actor to audiences. You know, the John Sayles movie Matuan comes right after this, and he's coming to America as this kind of jovial king,
mm-hmm.
and then he's in Field of Dreams, which I think, like, for someone my age, is probably how I got introduced to him in addition to Star Wars, where he takes on a sense of, like, knowing grandeur. You know, there's a self-awareness to every character he plays. Like, I'm the guy in charge, but this is all kind of a joke a little bit. He has this big stentorian tone, big guy's unmistakable presence. But he's mischievous in this movie, which is fun, you know? Yeah. Like, he's kind of waiting for the kids to go away so that he and his buddy can fuck around a little bit, which I enjoy. I mean, I think I ultimately like it because I'm an amateur James Caanologist. You know, like, he's like one of my favorite movie presences in the history of movies. And this is one of those movies when I was going through his career, I like was always trying to find a way to see it. Because mm-hmm. a lot of his movies from the 70s and then this, you know, he takes this big break in the 80s and then into the 80s are harder to find, I'll say. You know, like T.R. Baskin is not a movie that's playing on Netflix, right? You know, Slither. The 1973 movie Slither is not available to watch, really, unless you rent it from Amazon. Rabbit Run, which is like a huge adaptation of a massively successful novel. No one's seen that. You know, people have seen Brian Song. Maybe they've seen The Gambler. Of course, The Godfather. Maybe they've seen Freebie and the Bean or Funny Lady. But like, this guy was one of the 10 biggest movie stars of the 1970s. Most of the movies he made don't have a huge critical reputation these days. He disappeared entirely from movies from like 1981 through 1987. And this was kind of a comeback for him. Yeah. And it wasn't that successful, but it paved the way for Alienation, Dick Tracy, and then Misery, in which he becomes like at the center of Hollywood again, yeah. with the success of that movie. And he's a really weird actor. He's like this Bronx-born Jewish guy who's like a bruiser. Like, he looks like he'd beat the shit out of you in a bar. Yeah. And yet he's always playing against type. He's so against type in this movie. He's so like kind of yeah. tender and intellectual almost. And of course, he, like, you know, he throws some fisticuffs, but for the most part, like I said, he's this man kind of at cross purposes. He's trying to figure out like how he really feels about the world and what he's spent his life doing. And it's such a, I guess he said in interviews that he wanted to raise his son for, you know, 5 or 6 years. And that's why he kind of stepped out of movies. But what a weird way to come back. You know, it's like, it's so anti-archetypal.
I think the last, it's reported as well that the last film he worked on, before he took that break, he had such a bad time as well that he kind of like, was like, oh, I'm kind of done with this for a bit. And it's something must have spoke to him. And I imagine like reading this script as well, like you're saying, he's got a son, like reading that kind of, and that's something that beats throughout this. Like, I've got a 3-year-old son, and it's like anything with like a kind of father son, father daughter, anything that kind of like uses that like device in films, I'm like, oh, like much to my dismay, like when my son was first born, watched Daddy Daycare, and it's a film that like any other time, because like, you know, young like baby brain, you just like, let's put something on, you know what I mean, like any, like there's Netflix is on, let's put something on, and I found myself crying just because I was like, I don't want to be this dad who's like neglecting his son and stuff like that. So like anything that's got that, and like, I, again, like to kind of echo something I said earlier, that's kind of what's ultimately disheartening about this film somewhat is that, like, it kind of slightly misses the mark on making the emotional punch with that kind of, I think it is like the kind of, yeah, when it gets to D.B. Sweeney's kind of death, it's kind of like, I don't know, just kind of handed on and kind of passed off. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you kind of looked away for a second, you could kind of, do you know what I mean? The way it's shown is James Caan wrecking a break room, and then it's shown to the camera on a piece of paper, like he's on a deceased list. And it's not till like he goes home and discusses it with Angelica Houston's character that we really get like it fully as an audience. It's like, it feels like that moment should have been bigger. And I know he's probably like, I don't know, that's when it should have played for the cheap seats a bit, like just to kind of get that punch and that emotional reaction out of people.
Yeah, I wonder if Coppola is purposefully trying to be restrained, or if he is just sort of disinterested, you know, that he is there, that became something mechanical about the making of this movie at a certain point, because you're right, like it doesn't land hard in ways that you think it should. And some of that, I think, is the structure of the movie. Some of that is the beats of the film. I think his father's score is a little bit muted, honestly. Yes. For a film that should probably have like some big soaring kind of military, you know, tribal aspect to it. Like it's not quite at that level. But like you said, I mean, this is Jordan Cronenweth. This is the guy who shot Blade Runner. This is one of the great cinematographers of the 1980s. It's Dean Tavalaris, like you said, like it looks good. Everything on paper is right. And yet somehow there's just something missing, and hard to not chalk it up to, understandably, everything that was going on in his life and the kind of the idea of like having to cope with coping during work, you know, during like a mechanical process. So it's such an odd movie, and it feels like I always wonder if it was like kind of purposefully buried in a way, you know, like if it once it didn't succeed, there was a hope that it would be like, let's just kind of pretend like that one never happened. I'm always interested in that kind of movie that doesn't have that big.
That is kind of, I don't know, fascinating aspect to it. And like we've said, like Coppola kind of doesn't really remember the film, and it's kind of, it's like, yeah, that featurette on the indicator disc is quite hard to watch, because you can tell like there's a lot of heartache kind of surrounds this film, and they kind of, the final question is asking him, like, why did he continue making it? What was going on at home? It's like, I don't know, like, and that it is, I don't know, I'm interested to watch it again, though. That is one thing, like, because I find it wholly fascinating, like, yeah, like these periods of like people's careers that don't work. And one of the things I wanted to discuss with you, obviously, is like somebody who's a massive film fan and kind of, like you said, like you're interested in the movie brats, is what the movie brats were kind of doing at this time, because it kind of really seemed like a slump for all of them, right?
Yeah, I mean some of them are kind of not entirely, I mean, obviously you've got the Indiana Jones franchises going pretty strong with Spielberg and Lucas at this time. This is mid-80s, is right, Raiders, Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, all in a row, they're all hits. And so they're thriving because they're a little more craven. You know, they're making mass entertainment. So that's been, then we already talked about that. Scorsese, of course, is in this quote unquote down period, in which I think he's making really interesting movies. This is, you know, kind of the after hours period where I think he's trying to figure out, and he takes a paycheck job a couple of years later in The Color of Money. It is much more successful. Mm-hmm. Extremely vital, you know, based on a novel, IP that was not in his control, big movie stars already attached that he has to deal with. But he brings his energy, his style, his power to that movie in a way that is really invigorating. Schrader is actually making some really good work that is like a little bit overlooked. It's like the Patty Hearst movie is in this time, which I think is very underseen. Comfort of Strangers is coming in a couple of years. There's a few movies in the 80s, you know, Light Sleepers to come. Like he has this kind of revival in the early 90s. I think it's pretty exciting, but it's harder and harder for these guys to get money to make movies because the studios have kind of moved on from them. They're difficult. They have strong points of view. They're trying to make transgressive art inside of a big system. we're now in the heady days of Lethal Weapon and Die Hard and Beverly Hills Cop, and that's really what's occurring at that time in Hollywood. You know, there's a number of other people. Like Bogdanovich is trying to make his way back into the world with Mask and stuff like that. They're all taking paycheck jobs. They're all taking jobs to make money, to get back on the good side of executives so that then they can scrap together enough money to make passion projects. In Scorsese's case, it's Last Temptation, right? There's like, they all have their thing that they want to do that they can't do because they got to make more money to prove to people that they're not flameouts from the 1970s. So it's such a funny time for all of them. I mean Altman is in like the ultimate down period for him.
Yes,
he's making TV movies at the time. He's making, I like some of those movies, Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, and Streamers is around this time. Like, he's got a bunch of films that are the least seen of all of these guys' movies. They're fun to excavate. More often than not, I think, give or take an After Hours, a lot of that stuff is better left like less examined than the classics. The classics are still there for a reason. But what they do is, and we just did an episode of the Rewatchables on The Player, they do inform what you get on these big comebacks. And almost all of these directors, within the next 20 years, they get a comeback. You know? Scorsese's is a never-ending comeback. Like, he's been on now for 25 years and is just like the grand monsignor of cinema. But
you
like...
You look at De Palma around this period. He's kind of like on a, like, I don't know, he's just come off of The Untouchables. Like, it would have been the same year as this, right? So, yeah, he would have done that. But then his career takes a bit of a downswing, obviously, like, commercially. Like, Casualties of War isn't kind of, like, big hit as he's expected. Bonfire Vanities, that's a whole nother podcast in itself.
Literally, there are entire podcasts about it.
Fantastic book as well. But like, yeah, it is that kind of early 90s that they kind of all kind of really leave their statement piece of like. And what's interesting about De Palma is somebody like cover over on Patreon as like a little just looking at the movie brats and how they compare to Francis Ford Coppola. It's that early De Palma run, kind of like he returns to. I guess Scorsese does the same thing. They return to a world that they know really well to kind of like, yeah, like De Palma does it with, that you can kind of argue, Carlito's Way. He kind of goes back to what he did with like Scarface, and then Raising Kane. He kind of like goes back to the film De Brian De Palma almost of like kind of, let's give you a fucking like trippy Hitchcockian nightmare of a movie. And it's, yeah, I find it interesting. And then, I don't know, Coppola feels like he's taking a wild swing with Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's kind of like, it doesn't feel like Coppola still. Like, that's what he's kind of is, like, this outlier of that group.
He's, it's, in fairness, he does make The Godfather Part 3, which is the return.
Yeah, that's the big paycheck.
That's him going back literally to what launched him, what elevated him to a class all his own. Coppola is, and this is, you'll see that, you see this in The Offer, the TV series that is coming up soon. You know, he prides himself on being a very literate man, you know, on understanding Greek and Roman mythologies and Shakespeare and the classics, and uses those as kind of tent poles for a lot of his ideas. The Godfather is called on Lear, and you know, the idea of the great king. And so it's actually not that surprising that he would take something like Dracula, is considered a good work of fiction, maybe not a great work of fiction, but it is a well-respected piece of writing, and try to elevate it. And Gardens of Stone is a novel, and try to elevate it. He's considered like one of the most literate of all of these filmmakers. But he's unpredictable. You know, he's always doing stuff that you're like, you're doing that? Like, if you look at Twixt and Tetro and all of these movies that he's made in the last 10 years, they're all so strange. You know, they're quest movies where he's trying to figure something out in real time. Gardens of Stone feels a little bit like him trying to figure something out, how he feels about a period in history, how he feels about these relationships. Even if the movie doesn't originate with him, he takes parts to investigate. Peggy Sue Got Married is about investigating nostalgia, sliding doors.
Definitely, yeah.
That you make. You know, this movie is about investigating fathers and sons, like you say, and you know, that bond and the complexity of those bonds, and war and how we feel about war. And he wasn't really making movies about war when the war was happening. It wasn't until after the war ends, really, that he starts to dig into Apocalypse Now. So I don't know. It's always interesting the way that he shifts
Yeah. So is there anything that we should that we've missed in regards to Garden Stone that you wanted to touch on at all, Sean, before we start to wrap things up?
It's a really good Angelica Houston performance.
It is. Yeah.
There's a story that he was originally going to cast Michelle Pfeiffer in the film, but that he thought she was too beautiful, and that he then has to kind of correct himself and say, well, Angelica is kind of eccentrically beautiful and doesn't want to insult her in any way. And this is right after Pritzi's Honor, and she's kind of establishing herself as not just John Huston's daughter and not just Jack Nicholson's sometime partner, but as a real powerhouse actor. She's got Crimes and Misdemeanors and The Grifters to come, and she's about to become a really big deal actress in Hollywood. This is a much quieter performance from her. Very strange part, a little underwritten part. We don't totally understand who this woman is. We just know that she's an anti-war reporter. But I would recommend it for her too, because it's a really good part. Aside from that, I don't know, what a weird movie, man. What a strange journey for Coppola at this stage of his life.
Yeah, it's almost interesting more to talk around the film than the film itself, because as I said, it's definitely a curio to check out if you're a kind of completionist, or whether you're a Khan completionist or Coppola completionist, to kind of check it out. And it's, I don't know, I think it, when doing the research about what was going on in his life, it's kind of has a bit more of an emotional punch to the film, kind of knowing that. It's one of those rare times that knowing that stuff kind of does inform the work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you can hear my brain talking. It's better for a podcast than it is for a movie night. You know what I mean? You don't want to get the family all together with a big bowl of popcorn and watch Gardens of Stone together. It's not that kind of movie. It's more of a curio. You've got to be on an exploration for one of those key figures in the film. But it is a Rosetta Stone that informs a lot of where he goes with his career. I mean, I think a lot of the tragedy in Godfather Part 3 is informed by what happened during the making of this movie. I think a lot of the stories that he tells in the future is informed by that stuff. So if you want to better understand him, it's worth seeing.
Definitely. Well, as we wrap things up, Sean, I always ask my guests, is there any Coppola connections in this film? Are there people who worked on this film or in this film who worked with Coppola or any of the Coppola family elsewhere in their career?
Gosh, must be. I should have prepared more deeply for this one. Do you know? I mean, well, you've mentioned all the below the line people, of course, who have been working with them for years and years and years. Help me out here. Is there any?
So obviously we've got Jimmy Kahn is obviously in The Rain People, The Godfather, Godfather Part 2, and Honeymoon in Vegas with Nick Cage a few years later, where it's kind of...
I'd completely forgotten about that. Okay.
He's doing, what is it, PG, Indecent Proposal, basically. Angelica Houston worked with Coppola a year or so before this for a short film called Captain EO, where she acts alongside Michael Jackson. I think it's something that is near on impossible to find in the UK. I'm not sure if it's readily seen in the US.
Let me tell you a little something about Captain EO. I've seen Captain EO, and I saw it in person at Epcot Center at Disney World in 1986. In fact, I visited Disney World with my family, and one of the star attractions was Captain EO. And I remember loving it. The way the world saw Michael Jackson at that time was significantly different, and he was by far the biggest star in the world, starring in a short film directed by Francis Ford Coppola at Disney World. I remember it being great. I don't recollect Angelica Houston being a part of it at all, though.
Yeah, she's on the cast list, so I mentioned it. And obviously she's in part worked with Roman Coppola with the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which he shot Second Unit for, the Darjeeling Limited with Jason Schwartzman, as well as the French Dispatch being the narrator in that film. There's a connection there. Mm-hmm. Dean Stockwell in CQ, Roman Coppola's directorial debut. Oh. Then Mr. Wrong, which John Schwartzman was the DOP. Tucker, The Man and His Dreams as well. Obviously, Francis made the year after this.
This is why you're you. And why you're hosting the show.
I am Charlie Day in with that wall full of string and yeah. It's
the pinboard, yeah.
Yeah, cigarette in my mouth, kind of. A couple of connected like this, and there's a lot more. So Elias Kotas is in Tucker, and he's also in Simone, the Al Pacino movie, which again John Schwartzman was DOP. Larry Fishburne, who I think he was known as Larry at this time, right? It wasn't until Boys in the Hood that he changed it to Lawrence Fishburne.
That's a fact.
Obviously has had, yeah, it's had a stellar career with Francis Ford Coppola, whether it's Apocalypse Now, Rumblefish, The Cotton Club. And he worked with Nicolas Cage just 2018 in a film called Running with the Devil, which sits happily on Netflix at the moment, I believe. So
you did an episode on that film, did you not?
I did, yes.
And what was your takeaway from that film?
Adam Goldberg plays a really good like piece of shit, like
typecasting.
And Larry Fishburne has some real baggy boxers in it. That's one of the takeaways I've got from that movie. And somebody has clearly watched a lot of Tarantino and Breaking Bad and went, I'll write a movie.
Okay. All right. So should I seek that one out on Netflix?
I don't think so. I think, right, I think you could skip it. So let's rate this movie, Sean. And how we do that on this podcast is I ask my guests, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
I feel like you want to have a nice juicy lamb loin, you know, something kind of sturdy and steady to fill you, you know, maybe a little bit of blood on the table, you know, a little bit of thinking about heritage and some weight and some mass behind it. You want to walk away feeling nourished, like your iron is up, and a bit of strength. This is not like a light movie. It's not a sandwich of a movie, you know. It's not an on the go kind of a thing. You got to sit down and soak in it. Marinate.
You have a whole bottle. You got to pop that cork, and we're not stopping until the bottle's drunk. Kind of affair.
Yeah, but so what is like a Barolo? What kind of a wine are we talking about here? You know, something that has a deep flavor.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a nice deep red, like which obviously. Ties back to the film. That's what James Caan offers Angelica Houston when she first comes to his apartment. I don't know, something that's got like a kind of maybe like a kind of kind of thing, like a slight spice flavor to it, because it's got like an element of eccentricities to the film. Whether it's like, I don't know, it feels like stuff that's peppered in by Coppola in regards to like the fact that James Caan is just this Persian rug. Collector. It just feels like a weird like kind of character trope to
I do love that. I neglected to mention that, but I do love that quirk of his and the fact that he has such a level of specificity because of his world travels. So I mean, is it like a Syrah, a Mavedra, or like what kind of deep red are we talking about here? This is not a Pinot Noir kind of a film.
No. This is something a bit, I don't know, a bit off menu, I reckon. This is my wine knowledge. You've named a load of wines. No idea what you're talking about, Sean.
Well, I have, having visited Coppola's winery, spent some time there, I can tell you that most of the good wines are not on offer. You know, he's keeping those for himself. Nice. Got those deep in the cellar, and I don't have access to them because I'm not a millionaire.
So let's move on to the next question, which is, how much are you paying for this wine? Is it a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf wine?
Hard to get a cheap Mavedra. You know, you can't, there's no $9 bottle of that. So it has to be a middle shelf wine, I would say. It's like a $25 bottle, $30 bottle. But it's not high end. It's far from high end Coppola.
Yeah. You're not turning the page on the wine menu. Do you know what I mean? You're still on the first page. Like, you're not.
Very much so. And it's like, but it's not at the top of the list, kind of mid list.
Yep.
So, and you know, the sommelier would say peppery but plummy, I would say, is really kind of where they're going with this.
Perfect, Sean. So based on this film alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
No, not based on this film alone. In totality, in looking at the archive of your show, perhaps, yes. But I mean, this is a paycheck job, mid-80s downtime movie for a great filmmaker figuring out what his next chapter should be. So no.
Definitely. I can agree with you more. So let's wrap this up. And I always like to end this with two impossible questions. First one being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the family?
Easy one for me. I keep Francis. I think Francis has given me the most out of all of the Coppola connections. But I'd be sad to lose Cage, Sophia, and Schwartzman. I love brought to me. Especially because those are really more contemporary figures. Those are people that I didn't have to discover. They've just been in space since I've been coming of age. But I mean, Francis, do people say not Francis Ford Coppola when you ask them that question? What do they say?
Yeah, people do. Some people hold.
Do people say Roman?
No, not yet. But okay. I'm sure I'm waiting for the Roman heads to get at me.
Okay. What about Gia? Do they go with Gia?
No, I don't think she's made enough of a mark on cinema yet. I'm not sure.
So what are they? They say Nick. They must say Nick.
Nick's a big one. Francis. A lot of the time people say Francis because they I don't know, they get outside of themselves and don't go selfishly. They go like, oh, because of what he's done for cinema and stuff like that. And it's like, that's not what this show's about. This is about, like, speak from your heart. Speak your truth. I don't want to hear, like, the head game here. I want to hear the heart.
No head game necessary. I mean, have you seen The Godfather? I mean, Jesus Christ, what a wonderful movie. Yeah. Francis is my pick for a very obvious reason.
Yes, perfect. I always like to end on, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
The wine is peppery and plummy.
That is perfect, Sean. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and making some Coppola connections with me. Where can people find you and everything you do with The Ringer and Big Picture?
Yeah, you can find The Big Picture wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you listen on Spotify, but if you don't, I understand. You can hear me on The Rewatchables. I'm on that show with some frequency. You can hear me on the Prestige TV podcast. I'll actually be talking about the show Barry this season with Bill Hader every week, which should be exciting. And I don't know, I'm on the internet, I'm online, you can find me, just Google me. I'm thrilled to have been here. Thank you so much for asking me. Thanks for giving me room to stretch out on a movie that I will never be allowed to talk about into a microphone ever again. I really appreciate it, and I think your show is really cool.
Thank you so much, Sean. And there we have it, guys. Gardens of Stone is checked off of the list. And a massive thank you once again to Sean Fennessy for coming and joining me. This was really like a kind of dream come true for me. As I kind of said in the intro, I'm a massive fan of Sean's work, and it always amazes me that people are willing to take a punt. Obviously, you get an email from some random guy on the internet, and they're like, hey, yeah, let's do this. And what an amazing pick as well. It's a fascinating film, and I think we went to some amazingly fascinating places in this conversation. I do hope you agree. If you do agree, or if you don't agree, always feel free to hit me up on all the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok, all at Caged In Pod. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As for next week on the podcast, I'll be joined by Chris Johnston of the Easy Riders Raging podcast and the Spielberg pod to discuss the Jason Schwartzman story by and Roman Coppola story by film, Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch from 2021. It was a fantastic conversation. We get into our gripes about the film, our mutual love of montages, and so much more whilst trying to pick apart the anthology movie that is The French Dispatch.
If this is your first time listening to the podcast, or if you've been listening for a while, if you enjoyed it, please be sure to head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and leave a rating, review, and subscribe. Subscribe to the bloody podcast. Become a part of the gang, yeah. And when you leave your review for the podcast, please be sure to let me know what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. More on that maybe next week. I think there's some exciting stuff. There isn't any exciting stuff to announce yet because I think I'm holding back on Lost in Translation for a much later episode. If you would like to support the podcast by giving me a little bit of money, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where you can get access to our brand new series Movie Brat Bros, where we are on season one and looking at the films of the one, the only Brian De Palma. There's about six episodes up there right now, and they're a lot of fun. You get access to that for as little as £2.50 a month. It's like $3 if that a month, and it's a great little series. It's more of a kind of discussion. I normally have two guests on that, and we kind of go over the toss of Brian De Palma. We chat about the films. It's a bit like this, but different. We always end every episode by having a look at what Francis Ford Coppola was doing at that period. So we would have discussed this very film briefly and looked at who had a better year, Brian De Palma or Francis Ford Coppola, with the Untouchables episode with Rich Nelson of the Do You Want Me podcast, which is a fantastic episode. So do be sure to head on over to Patreon and join that. So guys, as always, I've been Petros Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.